Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And welcome back to another live edition after a couple of best ofs. And for those that are joining us live, why don't you go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page if you haven't already. The chat room is there for those that suffer a little bit from stage fright. As you probably saw in the lead up to today's show, this is a free-form episode where Eagle One and I will just pontificate about this, that, and the other thing. But if there are some questions you wanted to address to us, or perhaps a topic you would just like for us to bounce around a bit, if you don't want to call in, which if you're live, obviously if you're like most people and get this from the archive, this number won't do you any good. But you can reach the switchboard for the show page, area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397, and we'll go ahead and bring you into the conversation. But you can also just roll those questions and observations into the chat room as well, because we'll both be there during the course of the show as we move along. So let's get on with the show, and good afternoon, Eagle One.
Hey, Sal, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing quite fine, and just kind of kick things off today. If for no other reason than to laugh at the rest of the nation as they chipped and scraped their way through last week's winter storm. As those that follow me, especially on Twitter, though I did post a couple of things about it last week, I was in San Diego for the U.S. Naval Institute and AFSEA's West 2014 conference, and it's been a few years since I've had a chance to do something like that. But it was kind of interesting, and one of the things that I took away from it early on, and we touched on it a couple times here in the show, mostly self-referential to myself, but imagine that. A little bit of advice, one of the first panels was General Allen and Admiral Stavridis, and former Secretary Danzig was the moderator of the panel, and the subject was ostensibly on Afghanistan. Maybe we'll wander into that quagmire sometime during the show, maybe not. But really, it'd be hard for us to find a better panel than those two individuals. And Secretary Danzig, unfortunately for me at least, because I wanted to get to the questions, he kind of went off into a rabbit hole and did kind of a long bio on both individuals, which I think most people in the audience knew. But he started off asking about something that I didn't expect. He asked them about what, as they look back on their careers through general officer and flag officer, what were some things they both took away from the Naval Academy that helped them the most in their career. And besides the chuckle that people got about time management comment, the one serious observation they had before they got on to the actual meat of the panel, I did not expect. But the more I thought about it, and as I mentioned before, something I had clued into maybe a little earlier in my career, was the power and the utility of a network. And I don't think they were talking so much about, sometimes when people think networking, it's being an obsequious schmooze, trying to toddle along behind your mentor and get a good fit rep. But that's not really what they're talking about. What they're talking about was the development of a peer network. And obviously, they were well before the Internet era, which I think can help things out. And besides personality issues, I think technology has really enabled people if they wish, and it doesn't take a Naval Academy to do that, but to really develop a strong peer network. And it's something that perhaps we don't talk enough about, are the ways that we do it, because I know it's done a lot in the civilian world. You know, what have you seen, Eagle One? You got about a decade plus more experience in this little subculture as ours. How have you seen peer networks develop and change over the years? And what do you think are some of the positive aspects or the right way to do peer networking? And what are some of the shortfalls and the danger points you think people, junior officers who are getting into it and trying to find out the way to do it right, that they may want to avoid?
Well, back at the dawn of time when I first joined the Navy, the Academy guys had a huge advantage in that they seemed to know each other in ways that those of us who didn't attend the Academy didn't know each other. They knew, for example, that if they didn't know the person personally from the Academy, they knew somebody who knew him. You know, the 6-degree separation sort of thing, only much smaller. They knew what company he'd been in. They knew people in that company. They, you know, you had a general reputation that helped a lot for them to know each other. You know, the ROTC types, and some of us went to Duke, some of us went to Carolina, some of us went to Vanderbilt, some of us went to Texas A&M or Prairie View A&M or Cal or Stanford or someplace. We didn't know each other then. And so the reputation you had acquired was that on the first ship or first squadron you were in, and not necessarily one that somebody on another squadron, another ship would know you. I think that the electronic, and then again, you know, there were the other possibility for network was writing for proceedings, where you could get your name out as somebody who was a thinker about naval things. But in those days, it seemed to me there was an awful risk that you were really exposing yourself if you didn't have a good idea what you were talking about. I think that the electronic stuff with the blogs, the various group blogs that have popped up, your blog, my blog, the mill blogs generally, things like Sailor Bob and the Air Warriors rooms, you know, they all help people communicate about things that they've learned from that first USS first ship, USS or first squadron. And I think that communication at that level is really good. There are a lot of shared concepts that we didn't have before. You couldn't really share lessons learned very well across platforms in those days. With the advent of things like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, these possibilities grow even more. But as you have noted, the danger is that you become a link gatherer. You know, I'm not sure I really want Admiral Stavridis to be reading everything I write all the time, and I certainly don't want to be pushing myself on him. That seems to me to be a kind of a big danger. So somewhere between the Ned Ryerson, you know, from Groundhog Day to being a thoughtful blogger at the Naval Institute or at on your own blog, I think there's a balancer that has to be reached. And I think that for junior officers now, there's probably more space in which to operate and communicate with each other than there has been ever before. And I think that's a good thing. And I think also the senior leadership has recognized that and reaches down into a lot of those sites and gets ideas and thoughts and communicates with those junior officers. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And the you know, there are things, you know, you mentioned some of the group blogs, some of the self-generated and unofficial gatherings and conferences people put together, and some other, you know, projects that are actually being people are doing out of their own pocket in their own time, one of which we'll talk about later on in the show. But we got a caller on to bring into the conversation, kind of a regular here on Midrats. I think I kind of shamed him into calling in for us. BJ Armstrong. BJ, good afternoon. Welcome to Midrats.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, great. You over in the chat room, you brought up, if this isn't what you wanted to talk about, the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum in SIMSEC. For those that aren't familiar with them or haven't, you know, made the effort to link through to the few times that we've had them here on guest or things like that, What are those organizations? How are they run, and how might they be a little bit different in the marketplace of ideas when it comes to maritime issues that might get people's interest? And how does that kind of tie in to getting smart people together to bounce ideas off of each other?
Yeah, so your whole point, the starting point of the conversation about networking, immediately made me think of these two groups that I'm kind of tangentially involved with. The first one being CIMSEC, which is the Center for Center for International Maritime Security, which is really the brainchild of a group of lieutenants in a lieutenant junior grade. The idea being, hey, out here in the fleet or out in around the world, we have all these junior officers or junior academics who have ideas but don't necessarily have the ability to go to the big think tanks and get their ideas published or even considered. So they created this organization, Scott Cheney-Peters and Matt Hipple and a couple other folks, to get their ideas out, basically. And they launched their Next War blog and have started to put together events where they gather people to talk about maritime affairs. And it's a really interesting group because you bring in all kinds of different people, whether it's junior officers who are stuck in a staff job in the Pentagon through to retired civil servants who have been doing this for 30 or 40 years who want to show up at a happy hour in D.C. and give some wisdom and provide some guidance. So that's one example. And the other example, with CIMSEC, I've had the privilege to go to some of their social events, their happy hours, and talk with the folks who write on the blog and help them with some of their writing sometimes. And then the other organization is the Defense Entrepreneur Forum, DEF, which had a similar kind of starting point, was the brainchild of a group of JOs who had these ideas about how to make military service better, how to do things more efficiently. The DEF folks tend to focus a little bit more on technological solutions, I think. But they put together a conference that was held last fall, right in the middle of the government shutdown, actually. And so you ended up with these about 120 JOs, folks from industry, guys from Silicon Valley, who all paid their own way in the middle of a government shutdown to fly to Chicago to meet with each other and compare notes on ways that they wanted to improve their services. And you had, you know, across the board, you had Navy guys there, Marines there, soldiers there, airmen there, and it was a really interesting group of people to gather together who a lot of times had talked to each other online or on, you know, Facebook groups and exchanging blog posts and things like that, but the conference gave them the opportunity to meet face-to-face and eye-to-eye, and I was privileged to be invited to come speak to the group and give my gun doctor talk about William Sims and his innovations and some lessons to learn from him. But seeing all those people there just to learn from each other, just to make those connections, that network idea, that ended up being the real success of the whole event. You know, you get a conference like that together and maybe you think some great solution to some problem will come out of it. I think everyone left that weekend thinking, wow, all these really incredible people that I just met, now I know who to go to when I have another idea later on. That was almost as much the strength as any physical thing that came out of it.
Eagle One?
Yeah, BJ, I kind of advertised this thing as sort of talking about the USNI conference in 2014 West. Is there a huge difference between what the Naval Institute is trying to do with those conferences and what something put together by these GAOs like this Defense Entrepreneurs Forum? Are they that different, or are they pretty much along the same idea? We've got to talk about where we're going, how we're going to get there, and what it's going to look like when we're done. Are they more similar or more unlike?
I think that in your you know, broad description there, they do sound similar. But, and this is just, you know, my two cents, BJ's opinion, you know, not guy in uniform's opinion, just BJ, the guy on the phone's opinion. I think they're completely different things. I've actually never been to West, but I went to Joint Warfighter a number of times in Virginia Beach, and I've been to a number of the USNI events. And they're really good. You learn a lot at them. But for the most part, they're a dog and pony show. They're an opportunity for the four stars and the senior civilians in the Pentagon to get out of the Pentagon and come give their talk. You know, that it was that their whole team helped them prep and that they built their slides for, and they're going to tell you the way things are today and how we're going to solve our problems, which is good. We need to know that stuff. We need to know what the senior officers are thinking, and we need to know why they're doing the things they're doing. But events like the Defense Entrepreneur Forum are not about big-ticket names. They're not about famous people. They're not about lots of stars on your shoulder boards. They're more about people just having ideas and getting to know each other. And a great example is at DEF, no uniforms allowed. It's business casual. And so everyone from the two-star general that was there down to the midshipman that was there play the same and have the same name tag and therefore could just talk to each other. It's not really what you get at these big, whether it's West or it's Sea Air Space that's coming up or it's one of these other big conventions. It's not really what you get at those. At those, you're there to listen to the speech, hear what the guy has to say. There's not really that much give and take. Yeah, there's a Q&A, but it's not really a conversation. So I think there's a significant difference, and I think they're designed to be different, and that's fine. We need both. But to, for example, the first DEF-X, you know, so like TED has their TEDx's, which are the TED-inspired events. DEF is having the same thing now. And so DEF-X, the very first one, is going to be here in Annapolis 2 weekends from now on Saturday the 1st. And it's going to be a one-day event instead of a, you know, three-day weekend like we had with the first one in Chicago. It's just going to be one day, but it's, once again, an opportunity for people to come together and talk. And no uniforms, nobody pulling rank, there's no bad ideas, there's just sharing and trying to learn from each other and make things better.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things you brought up there about the no uniforms, and I think a perfect example of that was one thing we saw in San Diego. Without going into the things we were talking about, but we were at an evening event, and I had an individual I know grab me by the ear and say, "Hey, come over. You need to go talk to Admiral Fogo." So went over to talk to Admiral Fogo. We're all in civvies, talking to him. Great. And within a couple minutes, it was Admiral Fogo, myself, a Coast Guard JO reservist, two Navy JOs, and a Navy lieutenant commander just chatting away all good. Fast forward next morning, of course, he's in uniform, and I watched him come in. And you know how these conferences always have individual tables, and it was the morning event. He sat at a table by himself. Nobody sat next to him except for a one-star that came over later. It's like the guy was the plague. So we had a great conversation with a good mix of people with them, with no uniform, social setting, was able to really got some really great Chatham House Rules conversation going on there. But once you put on the uniform, it does completely change the dynamic. And I wish I could remember the individuals, but one of them at the Chicago event, he actually brought up, you know, here he was, he just stumbled into a conversation, you know, had no idea who the guy he was talking with, and found out when he came out the other end of the rabbit hole, he was talking to some Air Force general officer. And you have to know for the senior officers who people start lying to them after they make 06, if not earlier, that it's kind of refreshing to them to go dress in mufti and wander into the village, so to speak, with the ears open. I know Admiral Fogo and enjoyed that opportunity. And here's a question for you, BJ, is because these are kind of volunteer events to a certain extent, and I guess initially they're self-selecting in that you only have certain types of personalities there, have you had talks with anybody who's really trying to get a couple of attendees to show up who initially say, no, I'm not interested for a variety of reasons? The reason why I ask is you can always have a little bit of a bias into perceptions when you have self-selecting networking groups. Or do you actually see that as an advantage vice a disadvantage, so you're not wasting time talking to somebody who already has their walls up when they walk through the door?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, the deaf organization, I think, is a good one. From what I've seen, you know, as an example, they do tend to be technologically focused. You know, the examples of successful entrepreneurs and the folks who came in to talk included a lot of Silicon Valley talk. And a lot of the ideas of the ways we're going to solve some of these issues that were brought up seem to involve designing an app for it, so that people could share information more easily and that kind of thing. But there always seemed to be an app involved. And so, yeah, you had a self-selected group that were interested in that kind of thing that showed up. So I do think that there's some validity in what you say. The flip side of that coin is I think that everyone who went to the first event in Chicago and left, I would be willing to bet that, because I did, and I know other people did, everyone went home and sent emails or called two or three friends and said, wow, you really got to come do this next time. Because I think you would bring a really interesting take on X or on Y, or you'd be different about Z. And I think that network is just starting, and that's one of the things about networks, right? They grow over time. And so that example of that deaf network is just kind of starting, and it's growing. You know, this event here in Annapolis in 2 weeks, which there's still seats open for. So, you know, just Google Defense Entrepreneur Forum and you can find the registration stuff, or check out my post at War on the Rocks from this past week about it, and you can register to come. That network is just going to grow. Now, hopefully, being in Annapolis, a little bit closer to D.C. as opposed to Chicago, a few more of the Beltway folks might try to escape, come out to Annapolis for a nice Saturday afternoon, and therefore the network spreads again. And I think that's the kind of thing that will just happen by word of mouth. Yes, it's a self-selecting group. You know, there are going to be those folks who are only worried about passing the next tactics quiz. And going to DEF is not going to help them do that, right? If you're only studying your NATOPS, you don't need to go to DEF because we're not going to talk about NATOPS at DEF. So there are going to be those guys that don't want to come, and that's absolutely fine too. You know, we need all types in the military.
Yeah, I thought one of the interesting discussions, or actually it was a speech that Commander of Pacific Fleet, Admiral Harris, talked about as he was going through his speech. He kept shifting the modality with which he was presenting the speech. I don't know if you saw it, or it's available on YouTube at the USNI conference link. But he started out with this optical device, wearing like glasses where he could read his speech on this optical device, sort of like a heads-up display, as he said, on his aircraft, and then went down to an iPad and then went down to a piece of paper and finally just did it ad hoc. And it points out one of the things about having some adults in the room, if you will, not to make any reference to the deaf people, because I think they're outstanding young men and women, but he and Admiral Harris had an overview of how this stuff, you know, has to be. You can't always rely on the app. You can't always rely, just as you know, if you're navigating a helicopter or a ship, you can't always rely on there being some computer module that's going to help you out. Every now and then, something's going to go horribly wrong. You're going to need to dig out that sextant and go back to the old-fashioned way of doing things. So you better have your nautical almanac and all that stuff available. And I think that Admiral Harris's comment was it had to be resilient, reliable, secure, and affordable. And that's one of those questions I would have about these entrepreneurial groups who would like to have an app for everything. Is there someone saying, well, this is a great idea, but we also need to be a little slow in engaging this?
I think that's, as I said, in the Chicago event, it wasn't just JOs. You know, we had a two-star general there from the Marine Corps. We had a number of senior officers there, as well as, you know, senior industry folks. So there was a lot of sanity in the room as well, the kind of thing you're talking about. The other thing is I think that people realize that there are certain things that the solution set of building an app will work better for than other things. A great example is one of the guys who was at the Chicago event, Daryl Dipty, designed an app called the Emotional Vitality Assistant. And the whole idea of it basically is, you know, to address military suicide and depression, and it's an app that helps with information about that sort of challenge. And he's launched the app. It's had a huge success. He's going to give a talk here at the Annapolis event all about his experience in between Chicago and now with launching the product and seeing how successful it was and tweaking it and that kind of thing. Now, that information sharing type solution works pretty well for that problem. And that's the key, is finding the right problems and matching them up with the right solutions to work. And so I think that's part of what the whole DEF process is. That's why the network matters, because you may not realize what the road bump's going to be for you and your idea. You know, you may not have that knowledge. You have to study. You have to learn about, you know, other parts of the military system that are going to get in the way of your solution, the bureaucracy, the acquisitions programs, things like that. And that's why having a large network like that with all that different expertise in it, well, that matters. You know, SimSec is a similar kind of situation, but on more of a strategic or operational level. You know, they had a really incredible past week of blog posts at the Next War blog on air-sea battle. And some just really brilliant writing about how to think about air-sea battle, the whole debate over strategy versus operational concept, that kind of thing. And so they similar idea in that lots of people coming with different experiences and different visions, putting their ideas out there that all help us learn from each other. I mean, in reality, these are the founding ideas of the Naval Institute. If you're going back to 1873, you know, this is not necessarily new. This has happened throughout naval history. It's just that these are our 21st century examples of the network.
And BJ, be careful. We'll keep you on for the full hour. And I don't know whether you had a question you wanted to ask, but we dragged you down a rabbit hole. But I want to drag you a little further into the rabbit hole, if you don't mind. Because during one of the panels that I was sitting in on, it had the some of the crew members from the USS Benfold. By the way, their outgoing skipper was there, XO was there, sat across the way and made cutesy faces with Commander Salazar from Crick. Great panel for those that haven't seen the video yet. Take some time to go see it. Talk a little bit about the Athena project as well that maybe we'll touch on later. But behind me, and I forget his name, U.S. Coast Guard captain who was there the whole time, he brought up a very good point, and we kind of pulled the thread later on a one-on-one. And one of his concern is with what's being done unofficially is fine and good and probably has enough inertia on its own because people have personal ownership of it. But he said that in the question he asked for the panel that really wasn't sufficiently answered is what's going on with the Athena project and some things that the officers and sailors from the Benfold did out of their own pocket because the Navy wouldn't fund it, incidentally, is there's a danger of having some great work and great things done, but it quickly devolves into personality-based points of innovation, which when the personality, i.e. the few individuals, move on, that it evaporates in front of them. His frustration was, is in the Coast Guard, they've tried to institutionalize in it, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, we have the structure in place for what they've done on the Benfold and with the Athena project, but we don't have the innovative minds. Whereas on the Navy, you have the innovative minds, you've got the right people in place, but there's no infrastructure, official infrastructure there to keep it going should the personalities move on. And he was going to work on a sidebar to have a discussion about what the Coast Guard could look at finding the right personalities. But his warning was, yeah, Navy, you got some great stuff going, but you just have a personality-based points of innovation. Have you seen other people have that concern about there really is no official Navy structure there. Or my cynic is, if the Navy gets hold of it and makes a nameplate and office and a, you know, three-number and two-letter encode out of it, it's just going to get blotted out and not really be there. Is this something that's best being churned from the outside in, or do you think there's a chance to maybe institutionalize this like the Coast Guard has tried to do?
Okay, so I'll say this will be my last set of comments. I'll let you guys get back to the show, but I think there's a valid concern there. Twofold. The first one is kind of like you were saying about the concern about big Navy taking control of innovation. One of the concerns that I've heard expressed about the CRIC is this whole idea that, okay, the CNO is going to set up this innovation group. You know what that allows? It allows for COs and XOs throughout the fleet to say, no, you're not in the CRIC. Focus on the ship here. We're not doing innovation. Once you get in the CRIC, you can go do innovation. You know, it creates a stovepipe, potentially. Does that mean that's how it's going to work? Not necessarily, but it's certainly a risk that's worth considering. You know, as soon as somebody blesses something and it becomes an official program, then the bureaucracy can start to maneuver around it. You know, the organization can start to maneuver. So it's definitely something to think about. The personality part of it, I think that's just reality. I don't think there's a way to keep that out of the process. You know, the innovation example that I commonly use from history is William Sims and the continuous aim fire gunnery revolution at the turn of the last century. Well, if Sims himself hadn't met Percy Scott on China Station, developed his ideas about continuous aim fire, and gotten President Roosevelt to appoint him, basically, as the inspector of target practice, and then held the inspector of target practice job for 6.5 years, and think about how that, having the same set of orders for 6.5 years and being in charge of something in the Navy.
That would be a beautiful thing.
You can make a difference. You can, yeah. 6.5 years, you can start to move a culture. You know, in 18 months, you can't start to move a culture, and that's part of the challenge. Was he and his personality a part of the improvement in gunnery in the U.S. Navy right before World War I? Absolutely it is. There's no way around it. William Sims' personality is completely and intrinsically linked to that development in the Navy. So, as I said, I don't think you can get around that. The trick is, you know, having leaders who are out there who recognize that and maybe adjust the rules or bend the rules a little bit to keep the right personality in the right place at the right time. We don't have a lot of flexibility in the bureaucracy in the Navy anymore. We're very focused and very, you know, checklist-driven and career milestones, and you got to get your wickets, and you know, it's a very engineering way of looking at running a career. You know, maybe we could shift back away from that. It hasn't always been that way in the U.S. Navy. To go back to the interwar years, it wasn't necessarily the same way. But an ability to shift people and where they go on orders and get the right people in the right job, a little bit more talent management, can certainly go a long way. I think that'll be it for me, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, BJ, thanks for calling in. And for those that haven't been following, if you just haven't gotten enough Mahan, BJ's, make sure you grab hold of his book. How long has it been out in Kindle, or has it been out in Kindle from the start?
It's about 2 weeks after the paperback was released. So since the end of June, it's been out in the ebook format. So both in the paperback and in the ebook, you can find it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or at the USNI bookstore.
Yeah, 21st Century Mahan, that's BJ's book. And BJ also has been doing a lot of talking, and you heard a little bit of it here, Sims. Matter of fact, I got his book in my library. I might be pulling out this year and rereading to stay ahead of the power curve. But, you know, one thing before I let you go, BJ, one thing you're doing everything a good thing for is everybody's looking for the latest, newest, sexy Google Glass things. But as a naval professional, a lot of times you can see further forward by going back a little bit and seeing what some big minds are doing. And you helped a lot with that conversation, so I really appreciated it.
Thanks so much, guys. I'll look forward to the rest of the show.
You got it. Hey, and speaking of the rest of the show, one thing that I brought up there and I wanted to bring up, and we talked a little bit about innovation, and in the it was, let's see, you had a Marine Corps up on the panel about the Athena project, and if anybody's interested about it, you can go to athenanavy.wordpress.com. Here, I'll tell you what, if you're in the chat room, I'll go and put it up there. But you can just Google Athena project in Navy, and you can get to what you're interested in. But they had some JOs, and they also had some enlisted folks from the Benfold up there. They had a Marine Corps captain from Crick. And one thing that came up, they had the he was WEPS or a navigator. I think he was a navigator for the Benfold came up. Talk about a screaming flash of brilliance. It was good hearing a lot of the JOs looking at what, when we were pups, Eagle One, that we always did, but we don't quite do as much as we used to, is they're thinking ahead about, okay, we've lost the electromagnetic spectrum. How do we still put warheads on foreheads? And that was actually a quote from the panel, which is good to hear. How do we do that? Assume that your GPS is down. You know, how do you do that? And a real neat idea he came up with that is so blindingly straightforward, it's amazing. You remember as a JO taking out that sextant and, you know, feeling all excited because you've got within a few miles of your fix. That's, you know, if you're really good at it, you can do that. If you don't do it too often, you know, if you get within 10 miles, that's enough to get you home, but not enough to put a position and get your weapons downrange where they need to be. But there are some apps that are available that, remember, I have one on my phone that can look at the sky and use a camera on your smartphone to get constellations lined up and can do all that tedious work from celestial navigation and get you down to a very, very accurate position. And they actually have started talking with some developers how to tweak it so you could actually, using that type of iPhone software, pop your visual up there. Nobody can jam Polaris and Betelgeuse and the lower limb of the moon. It's amazing the accuracy you can get, enough that you can feed a position into your targeting software and get something you can throw a TLAM downrange at. But what was interesting at the end, he said, but we turned it over to the Navy and it's not going anywhere. He didn't say that, but that's basically the impression that we got. And I think that goes into, you know, one thing that the Coast Guard captain was warning us about. If we can have these small little ideas and innovations, but do we have and are we trying to develop a system that can say, holy crap, this is a great thing. This doesn't cost too much to do, and we can get this rolled out pretty darn fast. I got the impression that now that they've tried to have something official done, that it's absolutely going anywhere. Tell me where that's not a good idea and why that's not a priority, Eagle One, because you can almost see the look on his face, the disappointment. And going into a JO panel they had later, it's that disappointment where we lose a lot of our real smart people.
Yeah, that is where we lose a lot of our really smart people. And, you know, I don't know how much of it is not invented here and how much of it is that we give a lot of talk about having flexible, Acting Secretary Fox talked about having flexible portfolios as far as our ships, and I know a lot of other discussion there was about how, once again, we're kind of talking payloads and not platforms for a lot of the future ships. But simple ideas like that, which would provide a lot of flexibility. I mean, once again, I'll go back to the training I had. I don't know how it is I think for aviators, it's pretty similar. I mean, we always had a checklist. The checklist was, basically you always worry about the worst thing that can happen. A wing falls off, you lose your rudder, your main power plant blows up or something. And you had to work through that sort of thing. And I don't think that with the modern technology we have, a lot of times, I'm not sure how much we practice. What happens if everything goes blank? You know, what happens if not only you lose your satellite navigation system, but what happens when it's cloudy? You know, when you can't hold your cell phone up to take pictures of the stars.
That's one of the things. And sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to emphasize this point that you've brought up. Is that's another thing. You know, the networking thing came up a few times. Here's another thing that came up, and I'll start with Christine Fox. What a great talk. If people haven't followed the link to that video, they need to watch her. But one thing that she came up, and you could see a little glint in her eye, and she said, you cannot, I'm reading from my notes, you cannot assume a permissive environment that we have enjoyed in the last few decades. And that I believe is exactly the point that you were making there, Eagle One, is the fact that you can't assume you're going to have your GPS. You can't assume you have your IP bandwidth through your satellite. Your EHF antenna might not even be able to receive anything. How do you operate and not just float around in the water and in circles, but how do you, like the J.O. from the Benfold said, you know, how do you put hot metal on target in spite of the fact that you do not have that permissive environment that we've gotten way too comfortable with?
Yeah, that's I'm from an old on the couple of ships that I served on, we had some technology. Back in the old days, we used to transfer ammunition ship to ship using metal crates, sort of, to transfer the stuff. And the question was whether you use wire or this. Somebody innovated a new technique. We had a chain in between the wires, a lot more flexible, easier for the bosun mates to handle, to get it on the transfer ship onto the hook and send it across to the destroyer or whoever. You know, not an approved idea, but it was very flexible and it should have been an approved idea. And I think maybe eventually they did approve it. I have no idea. But on the destroyer I was on, if we're doing gunfire support, the navigator, you can take visual bearings, and at least, you know, within the range of the naval gun, you can take visual bearings on things, and you're pretty darn accurate. You can take navigational fixes, and you're going to be pretty darn accurate. The question is, as we've increased the precision of the equipment, of the weapons we're using, can they take imprecise information? Is that good enough, or are we so worried about collateral damage that we're afraid to throw two or three warheads at something where it might take one if we had the best of all possible information, for fear that out of those two or three, you know, some school bus may get blown up full of nuns on their way to church? You know, I don't know the answer to that. At some point, you've got to go back to the old school stuff, and you've got to go back to kind of old school thinking. We didn't seem to mind World War II blowing the heck out of civilian populations to try and get the Messerschmitt factory in the middle of a city. But maybe these are kinder, gentler times.
Yeah, I think below the surface of all people, but especially this nation, I think you scratch too far, and there's the same group of people that slaughtered 100,000 of their countrymen in a civil war. We can be kind of brutal. Who knows what it would take, but maybe we'll reach that point again. I really don't know. Another thing that Christina Fox brought up that kind of made me put my cell phone report as she has seen the QDR. She can't talk about it in detail, but she did give us a couple little nuggets to ponder about it. And one thing that she's emphasizing, that when people get the QDR this time, there's no peace dividend in the offering. Now, a couple people perked up because, again, it's an industry conference, more or less. AFSEA is industry, even though US and I co-host it. So there's money involved. But came back and also let people know that there are significant budget issues going on. So I don't think that means there's more money is going to come up. You know, she said it'd be great to be able to get more money. We need it. She said we needed a BRAC, but there's no appetite in Congress to do it. She brought up, again, the present compensation structure that was developed since 9/11 is simply unsustainable and is pulling money out of readiness and modernization in order to sustain it. Of course, other people had said, well, then you need to get more money. But she said there's no appetite to fix that either. And she said, in spite of the QDR and in spite there's no peace dividend, But the U.S. military is going to get smaller in the next 5 years, because regardless of what we think our strategy wants to be, in regards to what academically people think, that you develop a strategy and you build a military to meet that strategy, the reality is you're going to have a budget, and there's a close interlink between budget and strategy, and you have to have a strategy that can be executed within the budget that you're willing to spend. And that made a few people uncomfortable, but I think she's exactly right. And she also had a little warning here that, you know, there's a lot of temptation for people who want to withdraw from being engaged overseas, that they don't want to pivot to the Pacific, they want to pivot to CONUS. And she said, especially in the Western Pacific, that there's an ironclad connection between, as the U.S. influence decreases, you will see regional rivalries increase. However, we can be there to be as a catalyst to help these people who would otherwise have a rivalry work together. For instance, you know, we've seen, she didn't say this, but I'll use this as an example. We've seen the Japanese and the Filipinos and the Japanese and the Koreans do things in the last decade that you never would have thought would have taken place. And the fact that there is a false economy for wanting to come home and expect that that will make things easier, because in many ways a strong forward presence is a stabilizing force if done correctly, as opposed to being a destabilizing force. I think people can argue both sides of the equation, but you know, Eagle, what do you think is the national mood? Is there the national mood from both the taxpayer and their representatives to be that forward deployed, or are we just going to keep stepping back a bit? I can see both sides of it. I really don't know which way the trend line's going.
Yeah, I can tell you from living in a city which is decidedly unfamiliar with naval operations, that there is a huge and growing sea blindness, which we've discussed before, that people do not understand the Navy. They don't understand how the Navy operates. They don't understand the forward presence that a Hayes-Gray hull gives you if you put it on site where there's an issue. And I think that that ignorance is what's going to bite us. I thought that Ms. Fox did a terrific job talking about the things that are going to become a premium for us, including, I think she was looking at submarines as a hugely vital asset, given the way the modern world is working. But I'm not sure that people really, most people, I don't think they're against forward presence. I just don't think they understand it and why it's important. And I don't think the Navy, after 10 years of essentially two ground wars, I don't think the Navy's done a particularly good job of trying to tell its story about why it matters that we have these hugely flexible airports at sea and all the rest of it. I just think we you know, a lot of what's going to happen to the Navy, we've run ourselves by not telling our story very well.
And I don't know. I have some theories. Well, first of all, for those that read my post over the USNI blog about Christina Fox, I would love for her to have a couple of real strong EAs to do some of the grunt work so she could get out in front of some more audiences, preferably those without uniforms on, because she really is a strong public speaker. But I also had a sidebar with a serving flag officer I'll remain nameless, and I brought up something that I think really we need to have more of. We need to have the CNO out there talking about naval issues, and we also need the vice CNO out there a lot talking about naval issues. And if I have one more person bring up the topic of the vice CNO and want to talk about personalities and backgrounds, I want to throttle them. That's not what we need to be talking about and not what the vice CNO needs to be talking about. For instance, she did a great talk over at the Naval Historical Center concerning the War of 1812, and a couple people who were there said she did a great job. She'd do a great job there. She can do a great job anywhere. She needs to get out. She needs to get about. The CNO needs to get out and get about. Of course, you have to be invited to do it, but it shouldn't be too much of a stretch. And it would be nice to see the Secretary of Navy out there as well to get out there, get the word out. That would be the theoretical. But then I look back, you know, when have we had civilian and military leadership in the Navy to really go out there and tell the maritime story? Have we ever had, do we have a good template of that? And if not the Navy, you know, some of the other services, or is there a lot of hesitancy to do that because you open yourself up to various problems? You know, what's holding us back from telling that story with the right people out front?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I look at the Marines and think of how they've gotten their message across. And I think they do a magnificent job. We need to, and I know we've talked to Chin Fo a number of times, a couple times, and he's now moved on. I think he's going to move on to a different job. But the people at that level understand it. But it's there are all these grassroots organizations from the Navy League to USNI to a bunch of other groups that are not being used properly to really work on this type of issue, and I don't know, maybe not since Teddy Roosevelt, who may be the last guy who really pushed the envelope for the Navy and the fleet.
And it may be part of that. And again, this I think you because of our hobby here, perhaps we have a reference bias here, but. There, part of it might also be that everybody wants to be joint, wants to have good sandbox skills. People don't want to go out there and, you know, hurt the Air Force's feelings or hurt the Army's feelings, or, you know, there might be a little bit of that too much. I think that's overrated, as we saw a few years back when they were finding a new chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. Some of the services are quite happy to do some nasty stuff in the background. So it might not be too bad to get out there and talk, because when Christine Fox, not Christina, when she brought up the BRAC, the first thing that came to mind, well, two things came to mind about BRAC. One is when you do BRAC, you close military bases. And the last big BRAC we did after the Cold War, we pretty much evacuated New England and the Northeast. We also shut down and gave away a lot of territory on the west coast of California, which makes the J4 guys get twitchy when you look at major conflict out west and access to ports, so to speak. But there's some false economy there going with BRAC, because I think we have enough congressional districts where people not only have never served in the military, but they never engage on military issues, but they sure do vote on them. So I don't think that's really a great idea to try to get that type of perspective. We've talked a few times about it as well, about the problem in the Congress of getting the people with the right experience. So maybe you don't have to tell your story as much when you have, you know, influencers and decision makers who already know the story. That's a challenge. So I'm kind of glad that a BRAC's not coming this way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the BRAC stuff. I do know that the Army seems to be. You know, you can start picking on people, and that's the trouble. The minute you start saying the Army's too large for a force that we see future use for, but we really need an Army, but it needs to be a different kind of Army, then you begin to raise all those issues. And the other thing I thought was really interesting in the conference, the 2014 conference, was the panel on the industrial base. We don't think, just like most people don't think about logistics, in terms of our strategic capabilities, a lot of people don't think about the industrial base and its importance for our strategic capabilities. Years ago, I was getting my master's degree, and one of our instructors was a guy who worked for a federal agency whose job it was to keep track of, you know, if we do this sort of thing, does this cause the last shipyard capable of producing this type of ship to disappear? I mean, you know, it was interesting to me at the time, that was about 1,000 years ago, that there was an agency like that around. But I thought that was a really good panel and an important topic, probably for a future discussion on our show. But I would highly recommend people take a look at that YouTube video on that particular section of the conference.
Because, you know, it's not so much, and you know, one of the regular commenters on all of our sites, I think, you know, Byron, he's been working in the shipyard industry for decades, it's not only the industrial base that when you lose it, you just can't say, hey, can we have that up? Can you open the doors and turn on the key and have that equipment work again? Because it's all sold off. If you lose the people, you lose the folks who know how to do the right weld correctly, so your Liberty ship doesn't crack into the first storm that it comes into, which happened to a couple, I think. You have the people who know how to do it efficiently and effectively, so you don't have, you know, delays. You know, that's a huge issue. And, you know, talk about panels. For a lot of these conferences, when you get near the end, and this is right inside of your wheelhouse there, Eagle One, is what I'm going to bring up here, is some of the panels towards the end can be kind of thinly attended, regardless of how good the topic is. So you can really tell what's getting in people's mind when you're near an end panel discussion and the place is packed. and they had the China panel was packed. And an idea came up that I'll probably write on this week that really got my ears twitching about what you can do in peace, because a lot of people talking about, you know, war and the high-end conflict and whatever. But we have to engage with China on a regular basis, and there are things that you can do in peace to both encourage your allies who may be intimidated by their big neighbor nearby, but also ways you can help China from pushing envelopes so far that they've gone too far and bad things happen. And one of the panel members was a JAG captain, Captain Stu Belt, who spoke near the end of the panel. If you just want to see what he's talking about, you can fast forward to when he's like second from the end, going from left to right at the table. But what they were describing involving not only international tribunals, but treaties using Association of Southeast Asian Nations, a rule-based program that I use this term, he didn't, almost was like offensive lawfare against China, which was great to hear because usually we're reactionary when it comes to lawfare. And a recurring phrase that I'm going to do a little more research on, a rules-based approach to conflict resolution, and using that as a way to address China's aggression in the South China Sea. And I think A is an appropriate A in aggression is the correct term to use, because that ADIS was pretty darn aggressive. All in peacetime offensive lawfare against China. So putting on your Admiralty Law hat there, Eagle One, does that sound juicy, fun, and sexy for an attorney? And how much can we really do to apply pressure on China if we do that smarter?
Well, I think it is juicy and it would be fun to be part of. I thought Admiral Harris addressed that too. He a couple of times, yeah, when I was away, to mention that the Aegis was part of it. Well, there was another claim about, you know, coral rocks in the ocean. He made two cracks about it, both of which he said, you know, they're acting unlawfully and without any basis in law. So he's been talking, I think it was something like that. Anyway, he's been talking to his JAG officer about this stuff, and great possibility that is the way to go, you know, because the nice part about it is it gets it out in the open, where the world can see what's going on rather than just relying on news reports released by China and the other interested parties there about what's happening. So, you know, a nice effort to go offensive with lawfare, I think, is a perfect use.
I think another thing that really makes it exciting about it is when done right, and Captain Belt isn't the only individual who brought this up. It's not really it's very diplomatic, for lack of a better phrase. It's not poking China in the eye or kicking him in the shins. It's not going to it's aggressive in a way to keep things at a low level, to put China on a footing where they don't go too far, where it's hard for them to back out without losing face, but everybody else has to react to it. You know, I think that is what's so nice, and it also will encourage Japan, Korea, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia. I think somebody was talking about China just kicked Malaysia in the shins over something recently, and even Australia. That by showing that you're willing to stand up to China as they look to what in their mind is to restore what used to be theirs. It wasn't talked about too much in the China panel, but yeah, that's one thing I have to keep reminding myself is, you know, we think of our history in a couple hundred years and change. That's just a fraction of the Chinese history, and you just can't look back to 1949 as the template the Chinese are looking back. They're looking back, you know, more than 1,000 years. But to try to keep them contained,
you got to be careful with that. Looking back all that way, because if you look back all that way and you let them get away with it in the South China Sea, say, then what's to stop them from claiming that Vietnam is theirs, that Thailand is theirs, that maybe Thailand was the one who wasn't ever Chinese, but you could go a long way arguing. Yeah, you know, they go a long way arguing that everything belongs to them. I mean, all your bases belong to us, kind of thing, you know. I'm just not sure you want to go down that road. But let's take that as you know, people lose territory all the time. I mean, the Germans and the French have exchanged sections of their border a number of times. The Italians and the French, the Italians and the Austrians, I don't know, you can go on and on about who had what when. But, you know, you've got to draw a line in the sand someplace. The nice thing about the legal approach is that Vietnam, a small country, the Philippines, a small, almost unarmed country, have as much sway in the courtroom as the big bully China. You know, you can hire, both sides can hire the best lawyers and let them duke it out at minimal cost in life and property and all that stuff. Now, if the Chinese will play that way, that's great, but we'll see.
Always better to jaw-jaw than war. Speaking of jaw-jawing, I think we're already over time. Let's go ahead and wrap things up, Eagle One, a quick hour again. And I'd encourage everybody, go over to the USNI website and look up West 2014. The Institute has done a great job of capturing all these panels up on video. They have a YouTube channel with them. And there's just some great, and I would say encouraging, discussion for those that think that the American military, for example, is too misty-eyed and too kumbaya on China. I would invite you to go look at the China panel. There are some very people who are very clear-eyed, very tough, very honest. It might make you a little bit uncomfortable, but you know, sometimes you're supposed to be uncomfortable because they're uncomfortable things. But unlike things in the past where it had been hard, if you weren't there to actually see what ideas are bouncing around people's head, they've done a great job there to do. And speaking of great jobs, we'll be live again next week for everybody, and our guest will be Seth Cropsey from the Hudson Institute.
Yeah, I thought I too will recommend that people go look at those YouTube videos, because if you want the high level view of where things are, no better way than to see what happened to those conferences like the one the US and I put on.
Absolutely, you get to see what's in the head of everybody from Admiral Harris to Christine Fox down to a OS3 on the Benfold, who, by the way, she was very impressive on the panel on the Athena project. Clone her, she'd be a good take. But hey, we'll talk to you next week there, Eagle One.
All right, and I guess that means we're out of here.
We're out of here. And take care, everybody. Have a good spring, enjoying thawing out, and we will see you next week for another live edition of Midraps. Cheers.
The strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way.